Tonight on Arena, among the movies up for review, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, and in Parisian Lives, Deirdre Baer on writing biographies of Beckett and de Beauvoir. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. It's Thursday night, and with cinemas still closed, we continue with reviews of new releases available to stream. Ruth Barton and Donald Clark have been watching three new films. One a drama from the filmmaker Eliza Hittman, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. One a sort of essay on the film from the filmmaker Elizabeth Sankey on her love-hate relationship with the romantic comedy genre. And then a documentary on that tiny thing that can cause such big problems, The Atom. And the film's full title, The Atom, A Love Affair. Let's start with the drama, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. And as I said, it's Ruth Barton and Donald Clark who have been looking at these films for us. I'll start with a clip here. Autumn, played by Sidney Flanagan, meets her cousin Skylar in the locker room just after work, and the theme of the film becomes pretty evident immediately.
I saw you weren't at school today.
I went to the doctor.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
What's wrong?
Girl problems.
Bad cramps.
Yeah.
I get those too. Pretty much run through a bottle of painkillers like every month.
Yeah, same.
Don't you ever just wish you were a dude?
All the time.
Sidney Flanagan there as Autumn, and Skylar, played by Talia Ryder there in a clip from Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. And Donald Clark, as I was listening to that 32 seconds, I was thinking to myself, that's probably one of the longest sections of dialogue in the entire film. This is a very sparsely realised tale.
It is, yeah. It's a common tale as well. It's something that's popped up in cinema throughout the ages. When we think of Nell Dunn's Up the Junction in the 60s, Christian Mungo's 4 months, 3 weeks and 2 days, which won the Palme d'Or a little over a decade ago. It is the story of a young woman who finds herself pregnant and has to, you know, as we used to say euphemistically in the old days in this country, do something about it. In this case, she has an advantage over those earlier protagonists in that she lives in a country that, at least for the moment, and we trust it will remain that way, permits women the choice of an abortion. So you're dealing with something where you have fewer explicit horrors than you've had in those earlier films. She's able to hobble together a gym crack plan to get out of Pennsylvania, where you have to have consent of your parent to have an abortion under the age of 18. She gets together with her cousin and they crank this plan into motion and get onto the bus and travel to New York City where this can happen. Rather than that being an accumulation of disasters and horrors, in this instance, we're getting an accumulation of kind of variously sized inconveniences, a lot of which revolve around casual abuse by men they encounter here, there, and everywhere. A man who abuses them on the subway, her useless stepfather, those things. But the point to make about this film, I think, first and foremost, is that unlike a lot of films that you've seen before on this subject, this is not a horror story. The focus is not really on suffering. The focus is not really on outrage. The focus is on the strength of the central character and the agency that she allows herself. And it ends up being, in that sense, I mean, quite a positive film, really. And it's a film which allows her to forward the action and allows her, despite the fact that she makes what we regard as the viewer's errors, to take control of her own life and to overcome the obstacles that are put in her way and, as I say, take agency. Interesting in that sense, and as I say, ultimately ends up being a very positive film, despite being told in the language that we've come used to of a poetic realism that often tends towards tragedy. It's something very much more positive than that. And I thought it's a really, really impressive film, and one that's accumulative as well. It starts off slowly, thinks it's going nowhere, and ultimately it ends up one remarkable scene, which I think demonstrates Eliza Hittman's Tonnance's originality.
I'll come back to that scene, actually, because I want to play a very specific clip from it. But let me go to you at this point, Ruth Barton. As Donald said, this is a story that has been told before, the young woman in the unenviable situation of finding herself with the unwanted pregnancy. But the style in which Hitman tells this story, it veers towards documentary at time. It almost has that feel of it. I suppose cinema verite more than anything else.
Yeah, I totally agree with what Donald's saying about it. I think it is very positive. And there are, in part, you got it in that clip. It's this very laconic delivery. As you were saying, this clip was actually unusually talky in terms of the relationship between the two young women. So when normally when you get, a genre movie with teenagers in it, it's full of kind of high velocity chit chat and, tagline kind of bumper sticker talk. She barely talks. Autumn is really silent. She never really explains what her motivation for anything is, apart from the scene, I think, that we're going to come to that gives the film its name. And then the other thing that I find really, really interesting about it is normally in pregnancy stories, when a young woman is pregnant, particularly in American cinema, the audience is primed to hope that she will not have an abortion. In this film, because it's a sort of quest film, and she will triumph if she has that abortion, then we're kind of, unless you'd have a very severe attitude towards abortion, we're with her in that journey, and we want her to get that abortion.
Yet the film is not, you couldn't say that it's necessarily pro-abortion or that it's anti-abortion. It's quite neutral in the way it presents this story, I think. Is that fair to say, Ruth?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what I did find interesting was that the first clinic she goes to, as Donald was saying, I mean, they're very kindly women. And throughout her, the various clinics, she has to go to three in the end. She's met with very kindly women. But in the first one, they are pro-life. And so they offer her the two choices. One is adoption and the other is a pretty unpleasant, one of the sort of anti-abortion propaganda videos.
Yeah.
But they're very kind and very nice people, and it doesn't present them as demons, no more than it presents the very kind people who help her in the other two clinics.
In fact, that is the scene that I want to go to when she goes to the third of the three clinics that she visits. And it's a real social worker, a woman called Kelly Chapman, who I believe is actually asking the questions here, as presumably Kelly Chapman, the social worker, would ask questions of any young woman who came into her. And it's a very short section from that, but it explains the film's title as well.
Why are you asking me this?
I want to make sure that you're safe. Your partner has hit you, slapped you, or physically hurt you. Never. Rarely. Sometimes. Always. Has anyone forced you into a sexual act ever in your lifetime, yes or no?
I was annoyed at the title of the film because I thought, oh, it's so cumbersome, until that scene plays through. And she asks that, she repeats the options several times to several questions. I don't want to get into the specifics of the answers that Autumn gives because that might give a little bit too much away. But it's the way in which she gives the answers, Donald Clark, that I think is most impressive from Sidney Flanagan here. Extraordinary responses.
That, exactly. But it's funny you said about the title, because I was thinking, I can remember whenever it was, 2008, whenever 4 months, 3 weeks and 2 days came out, the people ended up calling it the Romanian abortion film because nobody could remember what it was called. It was a certain number of months, a certain number of weeks and a certain number of days. And it's sort of the same with this, and I absolutely agree with you. I mean, we're all kind of sitting around thinking, are we going to have to actually say the title out loud because it's so hard to remember? But it actually is to a purpose, and the purpose is that this, I think, a brilliantly economic piece of storytelling, in that with only four words to use, she fills in, or rather than filling in gaps, she offers us clues as to how we might fill in those gaps in her story. I think that's an incredibly economic way of storytelling in a film that consistently avoids obvious turns and obvious conflicts. So when she tentatively says never, or tentatively says always, to intrusive questions, to questions that hint at abuse, that is, I think, deeply moving, because we are able to, in a relatively short film that consists of scenes with relatively sparse dialogue, we're able to fill in details that would be far less impressive if they were delivered explicitly.
And in fact, even sometimes within the scene, when she's asked a specific question, she just looks at the questioner and says nothing, but that's even more devastating, or was more devastating for me, because as you say, you fill in the gaps for yourself. Ruth, how good a film is this? It's not pleasant. It's not like laugh a minute fair, but it's very thought provoking.
Oh, I liked it very much. I mean, it's a classic American indie film with. And it does, I mean, as Donald said, we've had this topic over and again, but I think it's just very, very empathetic. I think if you were a teenager watching this, you'd feel empowered by it. So I liked it very much, and for me it's a 4 out of 5. As you said, I mean, there are little moments where you would have kind of liked to tweak the plot perhaps a bit, and it's obviously very, very low budget. Fantastic performances. And a real sense of who these young women are.
Yeah, and it relies mostly on the two young actors, Sidney Flanagan and Talia Ryder, as the two cousins, Autumn and Skylar. Is this typical of Eliza Hittman's work? I think this is her third feature, Donald. It felt like Love and Beach Rats were the previous
two. I have seen the first one, but I've seen Beach Rats, which was excellent. And it delves in a kind of what you might call poetic realism, and a realism that is deeply researched, but nonetheless has a kind of spirit to it that kind of becomes transcendent as the film progresses. That film was set in amongst the gay community in, I think, Brooklyn, certainly in one of the outer boroughs in the United States, and got a real sense of that community, a great sense of place to it. And sense of place, I think, is one of the things that she does here as well. The depiction of New York is quite interesting here, in that it's almost like a 1970s version of New York, and it goes back to a situation where outsiders, like a midnight cowboy, though they don't have quite as terrible a time as Dustin Hoffman did there, find they're betrayed, they're plagued by maniacs and by eccentrics, and money is always an issue, and it's dirty, and so and I think she gets a sense of Manhattan and the outer boroughs that we don't see that often in independent cinema these days.
Stars from you, Donald, finally, just briefly.
I'm going to stretch to 5, I think. I thought it was a really impressive film, and I'm delighted it's getting kind of some kind of release in these difficult circumstances.
Okay, and available on Apple Play, on Apple and Google Play, and lots of major streamers, in fact. Yeah, never, rarely, sometimes, always. Think of the options on a multiple choice quiz, and you have the title of the film.
You'll get there.
That's kind of what it is. Let's move on to film number two, which is simply called Romantic Comedy, a kind of illustrated film essay on the genre known as rom-com. And this comes from director Elizabeth Sankey. Who is Elizabeth Sankey, Donald?
Oh, well, she's very interesting. She's done a number of things before as a sort of film academic and sort of thinker, and she's sort of she's somebody who's in the past has kind of like worked out kind of her ideas in film through movies, through documentaries that are that bring together clips in order to tell stories in economic ways. Beyond Clueless was a very interesting film about that picture, that whole world, and she's a very lively attitude towards how she contrives. Compiles these films, and I've got no objection to talking heads in documentaries and movies. No problem at all. But I think this is a much more fluid way of putting together a documentary on a subject. And it's composed, as were her previous work that she's done, entirely of clips with voiceover by a central narrator and also by various contributors. It is a very strange film, though.
Yeah. Let me go to Ruth on it at this point.
Sure.
Because romantic comedy kind of tells you what it's going to do. It's going to tell you. You think it's going to tell you the story of romantic comedies or something? A thesis on romantic comedies. Does she lay out Sankey? Does she lay out any kind of thesis at the beginning? Does she present a thesis and then go ahead and prove it? Or what story is she telling here, Ruth?
Well, This is like a personal essay. It's like, you know, the old days when people were essayists and you read their essays. So it's actually very much about her as well. So what she starts off saying is, you know, when I was growing up, I loved watching rom-coms. And, you know, she was growing up, she was watching When Harry Met Sally, Sleepless in Seattle, those classic, you know, 80s, 90s rom-coms. And she said, you know, this gave me all the romantic ideas and it filled my head with romantic ideas. And this is what I thought romance was going to be like. And then I got married. She points out too that the ending of the rom-com is the promise of marriage, but it doesn't go beyond that into the nitty-gritty. So then she wheels back and she says, oh, did those films fill me with unrealistic ideas of how you approach relationships? Because if I actually tried to act at these relationships in real life, I wasn't going to do very well. And then she also wheels around and says, well, you know, when I think about it now, these are all about white, privileged middle class people, and that's who I am. So they spoke to me, but guess who? You know, is excluded from the conversation. But of course, what she also then does at the end, she wheels around and says, but I still love them.
Yeah, it's a kind of girl meets film, girl falls out with film, and girl falls back in love with genre film. That's kind of what the story of this documentary is. Let's listen to a clip where she's talking about the influence of romantic comedies on women for good or ill, and Bridget Jones will feature within this.
Of all genres, romantic comedies are the films that are most heavily targeted towards a conventional female audience. And so they have the power to influence us. Well, some of us. We can see this in the way women respond to one of the most successful rom-com heroines of all time, Bridget Jones. Some feel positive.
Everybody kind of likes Bridget Jones. Like, you have to love her because she's completely who she is. She never expresses that she feels complete when she's with a guy. She got happy and content by herself. That's why Bridget Jones is just like the HBC, the head bitch in charge.
But if staying here means working within 10 yards of you, frankly, I'd rather have a job wiping Saddam Hussein's ass.
Others are not so positive.
You know what her weight is, and she's claiming to be very overweight, and she weighs about 9 stone or something.
Resolution number one. Ooh. Obviously, we'll lose 20 pounds.
And I do remember seeing that film when it first came out and thinking, I weigh what this woman weighs. She's worried that she's really overweight, so I must be really overweight.
My own feelings on Bridget are also conflicted. In the films, we're told she's a successful career woman, yet I think this truth is undermined by her many pratfalls at work. Bridget wasn't the only clumsy career woman I saw in romantic comedies.
That's a clip there from a film called Romantic Comedy, which deals with the whole genre of romantic comedy. We get a sense of it listening to it there, Donald Clark, just how Sankey manages to weave the clips in and out, really watching it with the voiceover narration. You're reminded of the films, and I don't know how many films she features, but I think practically every romantic comedy ever made must be in there.
Well, yes and no. We should stress that I mean, this is, she does talk us through earlier films like 20th Century, It Happened One Night, Pillow Talk, those films. But this is really about one specific era of romantic comedy. Mm. Those films are mentioned really as an introduction to the films that she grew up with from the late 80s on to the teens. So that's the first thing I'd say about it. And also, what's the other thing I quite like about it was one small point buried in there. She points out the fact, which drove me bananas at one point in film criticism, there was a period where a whole series of films that weren't romantic comedies were reviewed as romantic comedies. Things like The Breakup, she mentions here, Love Happens, another Jennifer Aniston film. And you kept seeing people say, reviewing them as romantic comedies. And I remember shouting to myself, they're not comedies. These films aren't comedies. And she recognises that fact. What I thought was strange about it was this, is that towards the end, she complains with some justification that critics, mainly male critics, are labelled disdain on rom-coms because they don't trust the genre. They're disdainful of the genre. And that if they call themselves, if those films call themselves something else, then they get better reviewed. But my issue is that she spent the previous hour basically dissing everything about the romantic comedy. I understand the notion that in theory this is a film about somebody who loves romantic comedies but understands difficulties with them. And Ruth has laid out all the issues, many of the issues that she talks about here, with the fact that, you know, that women are all supposed to be the guy's best buddy and they adjust their habits to the guy's habit. They're all absurdly thin. All these things happen. But, you know, towards the end, I mean, we have this thing where she turns around and says, why do people give them more respect? And I wanted to say, well, why don't you explain to me why they should get more respect? Because at that point, all you've been doing is dissing them. So much so that at the end, she turns around and says, oh, well, I still love While You Were Sleeping. I think, do you? Because, you know, an hour ago, you were telling me everything that was wrong with While You Were Sleeping.
Yeah, While You Were Sleeping being
I find that strange.
Yeah, While You Were Sleeping being the Sandra Bullock film where the guy falls over onto the subway, or the L line, I suppose it is, and she rescues him, but he wakes up and she has to pretend that she's his fiancée, etc., yeah, and all sorts of things fall out from that. But Ruth, you mentioned there the idea of diversity, and it was one of the things, when this film started and they were kind of giving me, I thought, oh, I'm going to get a history of the romantic comedy, right back from those beginning of the screwball comedies, and I'm going to see how it developed and how it became what it became and how it kind of disappeared in recent times. But it goes off in all sorts of directions, so I find myself getting a little irritated. I don't know what you're telling me other than that you hate them. Oh no, you don't, you love them. Oh no, you don't, you hate them. But she revisits the whole idea of diversity towards the end of the film and gives us some great examples, in fact, of films, particularly God's Own Country. She goes into there, Ruth.
Yeah, I mean, I thought we were going to get Brokeback Mountain, but we didn't. We got God's Own Country, which Donald's probably seen, but I haven't, but now I want to see. Because
let me just explain, for people who haven't seen it, a romantic drama involving two men, a Yorkshire farmer, a young male farmer, and an immigrant worker. It's about the romance that builds between them. Sorry, go ahead with your point, Ruth.
Yeah, so it's this, you know, gay cross-cultural rom-com. Fantastic. And the sequences look brilliant in it. So she comes around and she says, well, you have a narrative structure there that people like, and so you can actually slip a message into it. And she says, you know, rather the same thing about Silver Linings Playbook, though I'm not certain that I kind of believe her case on that one quite so much. But she says, yes, of course, you've got, you know, you can have gay, cross-cultural, all these branches of the genre. And actually, if we looked around, we'd find more of them. And I suspect, actually, you know, she just hasn't seen them, and that those niche audiences would be very, very familiar with the kind of films that she's talking about. So she's kind of, it does illustrate, I think, in the end, the real flexibility of the genre to talk to different people and the fact that it keeps reinventing itself.
Right, and did this film, did romantic comedy work for you? Did it make it, well, it sent you off wanting to watch God's Own Country and I'm sure other movies as well. Did it work, romantic comedy though, the essay?
Well, I actually liked it because I really enjoyed seeing the clips, and I think there's a really good pub quiz in this movie, which is a group of people sitting there shouting out who it is, and there are just those sort of nostalgia moments. I mean, I suddenly remembered, oh my God, Matthew McConaughey used to be a pin-up boy, and then I suddenly said, Zach Braff, what happened to Zach Braff? You know, they made him look gorgeous in Garden State. So I actually enjoyed all of that, and I think it's a real lockdown movie. A, because you could make it, you can make it on your laptop pretty much, and I think probably did. And B, because there's a kind of fun nostalgia moment, and you, like many of us, have grown up watching these movies, and so I'm kind of with her on it. I enjoyed it. It's a 4 out of 5.
Four out of five. I think if you cover, you could cover the every time a film comes up, it kind of the caption comes up on the bottom left hand corner. You could cover those, and that could be your quiz. You could all do it at home. What
Absolutely,
is this film when the clips appear? Donald, did it work overall for you?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's funny. I found it frustrating for the reasons that I said. I wish she'd worked a little bit harder at explaining why she liked them, given that that's the premise. But actually, I really enjoyed it because I love this. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to watch film clips, documentaries based around film clips or whatever. And this kind of fluid style I found delightful. So, yeah, I mean, I would actually stretch to 4 stars as well, despite my reservations.
Okay, so you both enjoyed that a little bit more than I did. Got frustrated with it, I must admit. Okay, let's move on to film number 3, a documentary called The first part is fine, The Atom. The second part really threw me. The Atom, A Love Affair. As Stanley Kubrick might have said, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. The ups and downs of nuclear energy are what's been debated here, Ruth.
Oh, I just find this the weirdest documentary. And it's the love affair part, as you say. I mean, because it's a really very quite pedestrian, quite plodding, quite ordinary story of how society embraced and then rejected atomic energy in the period, in the post-war period, going right up to the day. And so, you know, at certain points in the 50s, it was the brand new energy. And then, of course, you get various, you know, crises like Chernobyl and so on. And each time you get a crisis, it goes out of favour. And like, you know, the previous documentary, she has lots and lots and lots of archive clips. But what she's also, and this is when I say she, it's Vicky Leslie, the director, what she's also put in is these weird clips from exactly the rom-coms, in fact, that we've just been talking about.
Could have been in the previous film.
where people, you know, break up and they have love affair moments. And suddenly, you know, you're watching this very serious kind of bearded German scientist telling us about the atom bomb. And the next thing is, whoa, we've got to this weird clip of two people from the 1950s breaking up. What is going on with this?
The other thing she does, Donald, is that I don't know what Vicky Leslie thinks about nuclear energy at the end of this film. Is that a good or a bad thing?
Well, that's the question that kind of bummed around my head watching this. It, in theory, we should think that the notion of a genuinely balanced engagement with a controversial issue is something we all approve of. You know, when you're talking about films, you say that was really biased and that's a bad thing. And if you think it's balanced and presents both sides of the argument, it's a good thing. And yet, like yourself, I mean, after 20 minutes, for example, I was going to think, I want some kind of direction here. I want some kind of angle. What I'm getting is, I have to say, I mean, if that's what you're looking for, a genuinely extremely balanced picture of the 75-year history of our engagement with nuclear power, interjected, as Ruth says, with these clips, which suggest a kind of Adam Curtis light. You know, Adam Curtis, the English documentary filmmaker, who makes these wonderful collages. There's a sense of that, but not nearly as powerful or as juicily ironic. But yes, yeah, so you have Tony Benn pops up, who interestingly people may not be aware was a great striver for technology, and in fact was a supporter of nuclear power in the 1970s. And then you get somebody from Greenpeace, then you get somebody from British Nuclear Fuel, and all that gives you an awful lot of information, and you get that sense of how Chernobyl set them back, and then we learned about global warming, or we accepted global warming, and then suddenly this became a green energy, and then you had Fukuyama, and that's back again. All throughout this, I find that part of me. I don't want, you know, Michael Moore. I don't want someone, you know, for all his virtues. I don't want someone like yelling at me to accept his ideology wholesale. But I want some kind of direction. I want some sense that there's an attitude behind it.
And let's have a listen to a clip that might give us a sense of some of the archive footage within it. A very young Tony Blair being interviewed by an equally very young Anne Diamond. And here's a little clip from that.
And here to talk about this is Shadow Energy spokesman and one of Labour's rising stars, Tony Blair. Good morning.
Good morning.
The postponement by 6 months of the privatisation of the electricity industry is only 6 months. I mean, it's still going to happen. Is it really that significant?
I think it's significant because what it indicates is that the plans are a complete mess. And most people already realise that their bills have gone up in order to pave the way for privatisation. They've got huge problems because they want to sell the nuclear industry, which is going to be very difficult to sell. I think it's very unwise to embark on a new nuclear programme when we don't even know how to deal with what's left over the legacy of the old one.
Tony Blair there speaking in the film The Atom, A Love Affair. So an hour and a half is what we get in total here. If we'd lost the little clips from the rom-coms and stuck with the forward movement of the argument, would we have been better off on this, Ruth?
I don't think we'd have been any more enlightened. I mean, I totally agree, you know, with what Donald's saying. And in fact, I was kind of interested. I watched the clips, the credits through to the end, and I saw that it was crowdfunded. Well, you know, you have to believe it was crowdfunded by people who, you know, are anti-nuclear. But I mean, I have no idea. And so I think if you took out the clips, it would just be really boring. But with the clips, it's just really weird.
Stars from you, Ruth?
Sorry. Very predictable. Sorry, yeah, no, I'm misery here. I'm giving it 2 miserable stars out of 5.
2 miserable predictable stars, or for stars for predictability. What are you saying overall, Donald?
I'll give it 3 just for providing information that I wasn't aware of, but it's a very peculiar piece of work.
All right, that's final. At the Atom, A Love Affair, available on Curzon Home Cinema. The other 2 films that we're speaking about tonight, Never Rarely, Sometimes Always, Apple, Google Play and other major streamers, and Romantic Comedy, that essay film, is available from MUBI, and our reviewers this evening, Donald Clark and Ruth Barton.